The Bank of St. Croix has something for everyone. With two locations, the Bank of St. Croix provides personal and business checking accounts, online banking, and mobile apps for banking on the go, a nonprofit community investment checking account, and a 24-hour banking cash management platform. Bank of St. Croix Gallows Bay, Bank of St. Croix Peters Rest, and online, bankofstcroix.com. For details about our nonprofit community investment checking account, our service best.
Wednesday morning, and welcome to another edition, Hump Day edition of Analyze This here on your NPR station in the U.S. Virgin Islands, WTJX FM 93.1, with yours truly, Neville James. It's an immaculate day here in Paradise, Virgin Islands in HV, right? High visibility. It's beautiful. We can actually see some of the British Virgin Islands. That's how clear it is. And it's just 8 o'clock, just after 8 o'clock. It ain't like even in the afternoon, like when visibility to come even clearer. Right? I know you could see the western part of St. John. You could see St. Thomas, Tortola. Today's a good day to go by the bypass and take some photos and all that stuff. So, good day in Paradise, you know. It's life, you know. March in the Virgin Islands. You gotta love it. So, we got a great show today. We got Mr. Dr. Eugene Toll joining us in hour number one. He's the president of the Inter-American Center for Public Health Improvement, Inc. And then we got Omar Ursuluk from Flight of Wheel joining us in our number two. Of course, you know, and before we get to Dr. Toll, we had some more primary elections last night. It is now a done deal as it relates to the voting process. Both major parties, their candidates have been confirmed. On the Republican side, former President Donald Trump, and on the Democratic side, obviously, the incumbent, Joe Biden. And we'll get to that at some point later on. But I believe we have Dr. Toll on the line, so let's get right to it. Good morning, Mr. Eugene Toll. How are you?
Hi, good morning.
Good. And you're here in the capacity as the president for Inter-American Center for Public Health Improvement, Inc.?
Yes, correct.
Okay, good. Well, go right ahead. Well, let me stop you.
I'm sorry. I thought you were going to ask me some questions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got to introduce yourself, Dr. Toll.
My name is Dr. Eugene Toll. I'm the president of the Inter-American Center for Public Health Improvement. That's a nonprofit science-based research organization that I founded in the Virgin Islands about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
go right ahead. What actually prompted the creation of this entity?
Well, the need for local research information to drive interventions against the diseases that really create problems for people in the Virgin Islands. One of the things that I worked within the health system before, and one of the things that we're lacking is our own science. And so what happens is that a lot of the programs that are implemented are based on the science that's developed in the United States, because the funding comes from entities in the United States with their own requirements for how these programs are developed. And they're developed in such a way that they're based on the science and the research that goes on in the continental U.S. But the population here is different in a lot of ways, particularly in terms of the influence of culture and some behavioral characteristics that drive disease rates in the territory. And so as a consequence of that, I thought it would be important to develop an entity that can compete for research grants and do research and discover things that are more relevant to the Virgin Islands, so that when programs I develop for intervention, they can be based on local data.
What's your background?
I am a doctor of public health, epidemiologist, nutritionist, and general. I consider myself to be a disease preventionist.
You grew up in the Virgin Islands?
Yes, absolutely. Sure did.
Okay. Which island? St. Croix, St. Thomas, St. John?
St. Croix. Yeah, I grew up in St. Croix.
You graduated at the public school system or parochial?
Actually, I graduated from the St. Croix Seventh Adventist school system.
Oh, Seventh Adventist. Okay, good.
Yeah, the first 12th grade that they had.
Okay.
Back in 1977.
Mr. Griffin was the principal then?
Yeah, exactly. Sure was.
Okay, that's the good old days.
Yeah, in those days.
Okay, that's good. And then you went to college where?
Well, I went to college in the United States. I attended a few colleges there, undergrad colleges. Then I went to graduate school at the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
Okay.
And
what was life? How was life at UAB?
It was good. Actually, it took some adjusting at first, because just to get accustomed to the diet and so on, it was kind of different. But other than that, living there in the South was actually quite nice. Not big a transition as it was when I moved from there to Pittsburgh to the university there.
While you were down in the South, you could have still feel the remnants of the civil rights struggle a couple decades before that.
Well, not really.
Because Birmingham was a very important city back in the day.
Yes, it was. But Birmingham by the time I got there had changed a whole lot. But of course,
that's a predominantly black city, though, right?
What's that?
That's a predominantly black city.
Yeah. The majority of people living in the city itself are black.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, whether it's the South or the North in the United States, there's always undercurrents of discrimination and racial bias.
Yeah.
I think in living in like Birmingham, for example, you know who don't like you and who likes you. You know what I'm saying? Whereas other places, you're not sure who's who.
So it won't subtle down in Birmingham. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, there are people who were, basically wasn't subtle.
Okay. So when did you work your way back home to the territory?
Well, from the graduate level, because I've always come back to the Virgin Islands. I mean, when I graduated with my undergraduate degree in medical technology, I came back to the Virgin Islands, worked at Wang Lee Hospital for a couple of years, and went back to school. So I...
That's when you went back to Pittsburgh?
No. I went back. I left here and went to the University of Alabama, Birmingham. But when I left the University of Alabama at Birmingham and did a postdoctoral study fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh in international public health, international diabetes research. And... I was there at the university. I worked my way up in the ranks, and I got employed at the university as a assistant professor in the Graduate School of Public Health,
okay,
and associate professor in the School of Africana Studies. And then I was asked by Commissioner Darlene Carty, I think it was the time, to come back to the Virgin Islands to help develop their epidemiology program and do some other work that they had gotten some money to develop some programs with. So that's when I came back. So, that was in 2005.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, because that was when I was a member of my first term as a senator?
Yes.
And, yeah. Okay, okay.
Yes. Yeah, we interfaced during that period of time.
Yeah.
No. But that's when I came back.
No. In creating this entity, this data-driven database entity, right off the bat, what stood out?
Well, let me just step back for a second, because even while I was at the University of Pittsburgh, I have always tried to do to get grants and write for study, write grants to get funded from the National Institutes of Health to do work in the Virgin Islands and the wider Caribbean. So way back in 2000, I got a really large grant, a couple million dollars funded to do studies on related to diabetes in the Virgin Islands and to understand why the population had changed from a low diabetes frequency population to a high diabetes frequency population. So I've always done that. I've done studies. I've gotten studies from the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation. I set up registries for type 1 diabetes in children in the Virgin Islands long before I actually came back to work with the and funded and started my own organization. So I already had some ideas that I wanted to some ideas and areas that I wanted to focus on when I developed my my research entity. And so that entity was focused more on trying to understand how to prevent disease as opposed to looking at what are the factors that drive disease. Yeah.
And there's a distinction there. Break that down for the audience, if you will.
Yeah, there's what we call translational research, and then there's research for the purpose of just simply advancing the science. Right? So if something is not known about a particular topic, then
looks like we may have lost Dr. Tolder. But he was mentioning the distinction between gathering data and the end game in different instances, right? In one instance, you could gather data, like he said, for transactional purposes, and then in another instance, you could do things. You could gather data because you really need to have the impact to know what's going on down the road. Hopefully, we could get Dr. Tull back on again, so we could continue this discussion. I think we have Dr. Tull back on again. Good morning, Doc.
Hey, sorry about that. Looks like we had a drop call.
Yeah, we had a drop call. Yeah, that happens. Yeah. So you were explaining the distinction in the data gathering process. Break that down again, please.
Yeah. So the distinction in terms of the types of research that
types
that
of
can
research.
Be done.
Yeah.
So one is just simply to try to get information to better understand a problem.
Yeah. And a society. Yeah.
Yes. In a particular population. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the information you're gathering is going to have practical applications.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other one is when you do research, we call it translational research. So we do research to specifically try to find applications that can make a difference now. And so that's where my new my research organization I created, that's why I founded it, to do that type of research as opposed to simply doing research to create a basic understanding.
Okay, and so this started, what, about 10 years ago, you said?
Actually, the entity was created in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a collaborative grant I did with the University of the Virgin Islands not long after that, in the same year. And then subsequent to that, I did some other projects independently. And then I got another grant from the NIH in 2018. And right now we're trying to just get ourselves back from COVID.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, good. How was that relationship with the university?
It was pretty good. I mean, it was nice and collaborative. I'm not sure that the research entity that was there is still operational because, you know, monies come and go. But it was collaborative. Yeah, it was good.
That's good to hear. Diabetes prevalent in the Virgin Islands?
Very much so. In fact, like I mentioned before, that one study I got, monies I got from the NIH to study diabetes here in 2000 was because it was recognized that it was the place had changed dramatically from being a place where diabetes rates were low to one where it had become higher. So this was back in 2000. And so without meaningful intervention, without community-based approaches to change things, then the rates will continue to rise until it gets to a level where it sort of plateaus and it's doesn't change very much. So it's already high here, yes.
No, the rates were low. Knowing, having data to justify this, or the rates were low because we weren't gathering the requisite data?
Yeah, the rates were low because there was some preliminary data that I was able to show that were collected back in the 80s that were that was a good it was reasonable estimate of what was happening in the population. So the estimates were around 2 per 100,000, 2.4, 2.5 per 100,000 people with diabetes back in the early 80s, for example. And then around the 1990s, from the 1990s on, there has been consistent information gathered by the CDC to look at the prevalence. So even with that data alone, you could see that the rates will continually on the rise. But yeah, going back to the early 1980s, around 2 point something per 100,000 people with diabetes, or 2%. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
about 2% of the population.
Okay.
Now it's
hold on a second. We'll take a break. We're talking with Dr. Eugene Tull. He's the president of the Inter-American Center for Public Health Improvement, Inc. We'll be right back after this.
Bank of St. Croix has something for everyone. With two locations, the Bank of St. Croix provides personal and business checking accounts, online banking, and mobile apps for banking on the go, a nonprofit community investment checking account, and a 24-hour banking cash management platform. Bank of St. Croix, Gallows Bay, Bank of St. Croix, Peters Rest, and online, bankofstcroix.com. For details about our nonprofit community investment checking account, our service specialists are ready to help. Bank of St. Croix, member FDIC.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we are not afraid to stand up to the high and mighty like Jeff Bezos.
He had that big cowboy hat on. He looked like a shrink ray had hit Garth Brooks.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join me as we speak truth to power, at least until power agrees to buy us out, on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. right here on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
He said that black smoke was constantly coming out of the burn pits 24/7. And my reaction to it was like, wow, that doesn't sound very safe. I wonder what that's about. And in my mind, I couldn't imagine at the time that type of system operating could potentially harm our service members.
Journalism that seeks and reveals. That's On Point with me, Meghna Chakrabarty.
Weekdays at 1 p.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
These icebergs are amazing.
Journey to the icy ends of the earth.
It just looks like Mars.
Where the secrets of the past.
We're on a beach.
We're on a beach 3 million years ago.
Hold the clues to our future.
This place is so amazing.
This is the stuff that gives us a glimpse into a past warmer world.
Humans are geology. We are impacting this planet.
Polar Extremes on Nova.
Tune in March 20th at 9 p.m. on WTJX TV Channel 12.
And we're back here analyze this, and we're having a discussion with Dr. Tull, for the president for Inter-American Center for Public Health Improvement. And good morning once again, Dr. Tull.
Good morning, sir.
Okay, good. So you said 2%, so that's 2 for every 100 then?
Yeah, roughly around 2 for every 100. But understand this, that mostly when you're talking about diabetes, we typically are talking about looking at the disease in people who are age 20 and above.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this is, we're talking about diabetes in adults. So, age 20 and above. But understanding that the rates are higher as you go up in age, right? So let's take, for example, now, let's say the rates are maybe around 14 of diagnosed diabetes. And again, another thing, diagnosed versus undiagnosed, right? So let's say diagnosed diabetes is around 14% now, okay, which is high. That's in people who are age 20 and above. If you take out the people who are less likely to have diabetes, who are like age 30 and below, then you're talking age 31 or even age 35 and above, you're talking a higher rate. So it could be as high as 22% in that number. When you go up into older ranges, like people 40 and above, it's like 1 in 3. Right?
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's a significant jump.
Yeah. So when you hear the numbers are generally provided for age 20 and above. But when you think about diabetes as a problem, it usually appears around age 40 and up. And in those individuals, the numbers, the percentage is actually very high. Could be 1 in 3, for
example. Mm-hmm. And have we looked at the source of this? Is it hereditary? Is it diet? What are we looking at?
I can only speak from the standpoint, I can tell you what generally the risk factors are.
Okay.
And then I can tell you specifically other things that I have looked at in the Virgin Islands itself. Okay?
Okay.
So generally, the risk factors for diabetes in adults, what we call type 2 diabetes, that you predominate in adults, overweight, physical inactivity, and stress. Those would be the three main factors that drive it. Okay? Overweight, physical inactivity, and stress.
Mm-hmm.
Then that happens at the individual level, right? Then you have higher level factors, for example, that I've looked at that can change rates in a population. So, for example, I've looked at the issue of acculturation, right? So why would a population change from low to high, right? The people themselves don't necessarily we haven't had a change in genetics. You know, genetics, I'm going to throw out genetics because 90% of the people who develop diabetes have some diabetes gene, and most people clone a diabetes gene. So having diabetes doesn't make you unique in terms of a genetic person. So most of the people who have developed diabetes have the diabetes gene, right? So genetics is a given.
Mm-hmm.
That most people will have a gene that predisposes them to diabetes. Now, since that doesn't change much in a population, then what we want to look at are other factors that might drive rates and make them increase, right? So one is acculturation, that is changing your lifestyle patterns. So what I've done studies showing that adopting patterns, behavioral patterns, attitudinal patterns that are more like that of the continental United States is associated with a greater risk of developing diabetes. And within that, you have, of course, you change your diet, your activity level, and so on and so forth. Your ability to manage the stressors in life and the stresses that you're exposed to within a community also influences your risk of diabetes. And I've presented a study on that and published research on that area as well.
You work with other data gathering entities?
Well, when you say data gathering,
well, other entities, you know, like the actual Department of Health itself and other medically entities sharing information. Information sharing is a part of what we're trying to accomplish here for the general welfare of the society.
That's just a part of what we do as researchers. We have to share the information.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I mean, we're going back to the mid-1990s when I really started doing research in a meaningful way here. I've talked to groups from the Department of Health, all over, you know, diabetes-related groups. But all of that is just talk, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that the things that are discovered are going to be put into interventions that are going to impact the population as a whole, right? I mean, I can present all the information I want, and people can hear it. But unless there are folk who are willing to take the mantle and say, well, okay, we're going to try to develop some program to implement this sort of stuff, then nothing's going to happen, and things continue as they are. So, again, that's one of the reasons why I developed this entity, to get into the intervention part of things, so that at least we can try some programs and, you know, that will be driven by funds that we get to help people with diabetes, to help prevent diabetes and other things.
Talk a little bit about the federal government and why it's important for them to actually be aware of the demographics, the trends in the insular possessions. You know, people, you know, tend to assume that, you know, everything gonna be all right, we're in American jurisdiction, what have you. But the reality is, you know, the Guams, the American Samoas, the Northern Marianas, the Virgin Islands, the insular possessions under the Department of Interior, we really require, due to our unique circumstances, more attention to detail as it relates to, you know, people of color and the fact that we are detached from mainland America.
Okay. So you raised some some very important points there, and I'm going to try to address them within the context of disease process and so forth. All right, so the people, the entities in the United States, like, for example, the CDC, HHS, NIH, they try hard to work with the insular groups, right? They work primarily, we're talking about disease, they work primarily through your departments of health.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're involved. When I was there, I mean, we were involved in a lot of things that were happening across the country when problems arose and so forth. With respect to things like diabetes, for example, there are programs that are funded by the feds that are focused on diabetes, and they do have opportunities for local, usually it's through the Department of Health, the government agency, to apply for funds for those programs. But like I said before, the challenge is that the science upon which the programs are developed is developed based on the USA. It's not developed based on the diverse insular entities that are there. So when the programs are written and then you apply for them, you have to apply the programs according to how they're set up, not necessarily according to what is most important for your group.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that brings us back to the other.
No, because here on this show, every Monday, we have a table talk discussion with former senators, myself, Senator Rocky Laybutt from St. John, Senator Donald Duck School from St. Thomas, and Senator Ronnie Russell from St. Croix.
Okay.
And we were speaking about education, right? We're talking about curriculum, things of that nature. And one of the consensus opinions of us, of our discussion on Monday, was that, and we're talking about Department of Education in this instance, there's this belief that one-size-fits-all approach is what works, when in fact you are literally articulating a position that we took, which is given, because we were talking about history and needing to shape our curriculum to satisfy, you know, what we believe are the needs as relates to educating the people in the Virgin Islands. In your case, you're saying the mainland, they put together these formulas, what have you, but in many instances they don't modify it to satisfy the insular possessions.
Right. You apply it according to the patterns that are set up within the context of the program. So,
and the same thing happened, because when we were following the data during the pandemic, March was when we a year ago today, actually. I mean, 4 years ago today, right, was when we actually had our first documented case, right? Even though we know looking backwards now that COVID was actually here prior to, right?
Right.
But it wasn't documented, right?
Right.
So in September of that year, one of my good friends, like a mentor, he went to school with Richard, he was like 4 or 5 grades ahead of me. He sent me an article where a lot of the original data for COVID-19 as it relates to formula and projections were coming out of University of Washington, right?
Correct.
In Seattle. And they had predicted that we would have we could have 300 to 500 deaths, right? COVID-related deaths here between September and December of 2020, right? And that was using the formula that they were applying throughout the country. What they didn't know was that half of the population was separated from the other half because of the islands. You follow what I'm saying? So that particular formula did not apply. And we never had the kind of numbers that they had projected. And I think that's a classic example of what you're talking about with respect to...
Precisely, and I give you a simple example from the diabetes arena. Based on the prevalence of diabetes that we have in the Virgin Islands, there should be a lot more people with heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't exist because the population, because if you look at the data across the board, even among Caribbean people living in the United States, they have equal, for example, African Americans have higher rates of heart disease than white Americans, okay? Especially among people with diabetes. But the rates of heart disease in people with diabetes here is much lower because people here, as a general rule, don't smoke a lot. And smoking drives rates up. And so a behavioral pattern like that changes the way and the expectations for what you might see. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So it's things like that. And so there are behavioral patterns that vary between here and the U.S. that are protective. And just the same, like I said before, there's a acculturation. There's this process of acculturation that's been going on for a century now, right? And with each generation that comes, the population becomes more and more acculturated. And so a lot, what will happen in time that there would hardly be any difference between a continental and a person living in the Virgin Islands because of the way that we live and the way we approach life would be very, very similar to the continental U.S. I published a paper, on fast food eating and its relationship to insulin resistance, which is a precursor for diabetes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I showed that people who ate at fast food restaurants more than two times per week had an increased risk of developing this insulin resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And that the people who were eating more were the people who are more acculturated, the people who are more like people in the United States. Those are ones who are there eating more at the fast food restaurants, right? So acculturation changes. One of the things it changes is your value perception. And so the one value that is associated with the change in acculturation here is convenience. So the more acculturated you become, the more you value convenience. And a lot of the things that protected you in the past were not very convenient. Preparing your own meals, having a backyard with a lot of leaves and fruit trees and drinking bush tea and all these things that protected you from diabetes and overweight and so on. These things are seen as less convenient because nobody wants to clean up leaves in their backyard anymore. So everybody has grass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hold on 1 second. We're going to take a break and pick up the discussion there as it relates to the trends that could actually impact why certain folks are susceptible to diabetes and things of that nature. We're talking with Dr. Eugene Tull. We'll take a break. We'll be back right after this.
UVI's annual Friendraiser Afternoon on the Green is back on Sunday, March 17th from noon to 5 p.m. on the UVI Golf Course on St. Thomas. Enjoy mouthwatering dishes, music by RVP Band and Shaw HP, plus face painting and bouncy houses for the kids. Register online for the best dress and hat competition. Visit aog.uvi.edu. Sponsored by VIA, VI Council on the Arts, Hogland VI, and First Bank.
I'm Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday. In these divided times, what could be more important than a conversation? Conversation with someone we don't know, someone we think we know, someone with whom we disagree or think we do. Join us as we ask questions of politicians, ranchers, parents, athletes, activists, gardeners, writers, and lots more. Then listen along with you.
Weekend Edition, Saturdays at 9 a.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
Music can be an incredibly personal experience. A song can inspire you, it can comfort you, it can make you feel understood, but it can even take you back to a specific moment in your life. And it all begins with the artist. Join me, Raina Duras, as I get personal through in-depth interviews with your favorite musicians and find out where those songs come from on World Cafe.
Weekdays at 10 p.m. on WTJX FM 93.1.
Meet six extraordinary women who forged their own answers to a profound question.
As a black woman, how does it feel to be free?
Lena Horne, Abby Lincoln.
They blaze such a trail.
Nina Simone.
Voice of the civil rights movement.
Cicely Tyson.
Accepted for her talent alone.
Diane Carroll.
We're at a new crossroads.
Pam Grier.
First female action hero in American film.
Look for How It Feels to Be Free.
We'll see what happens here.
On American Masters.
Tune in March 9th at 8 p.m. on WTJX TV Channel 12.
And we're back here, and Liz is having a good discussion with Dr. Eugene Tull, who's the president of the Inter-American Center for Public Health Improvement, Inc. We were talking here about trends and what the data is telling us with respect to the population here in the Virgin Islands. Good morning again, Dr. Tull. Glad to have you on.
Good morning.
Okay, good. So you were talking about the propensity for our desire, right, to like to eat fast food, to include myself, right? So you're putting me on notice now, right? And the potential risks, what have you. And the data has shown that eating at fast foods, what, twice a week?
More than twice a week.
More than twice a week. You're running the risk of increase.
It's associated with insulin resistance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't think about this concept of insulin resistance. It's when your body, your cells of your body don't respond well to insulin, okay? And so the same things that are risk factors for diabetes are the same risk factors for insulin resistance, which is like a precursor to diabetes. So what happens with people is this, and I'll get back to the trends in a second, but I think this is important for people to understand. So let's say you carry on excess weight, okay? That excess weight influences how your body responds to insulin. And so as a consequence of your body becomes more resistant, so it doesn't respond as efficiently and as quickly and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so what your body does is starts producing more insulin. It says, okay, this is not enough. I'm going to produce more. So you go into a state of what we call hyperinsulinemia, all right? So you have this insulin resistance because you're overweight, you're inactive, right? And that develops. And then you carry this around for 10, 15 years. This is the problem. And then ultimately, your body cannot compensate anymore, so your blood sugar rises. But it happens over the course of time. So when you're diagnosed with diabetes, you could have had diabetes for a couple of years before that. And your body has been going through the changes leading up to diabetes for 10 years before that. All right. So carry around this excess weight and so forth for a long period of time and being inactive is part of the problem. But the trends that have been happening in the population have been supporting this sort of situation where we have people overweight and so on and inactive. Like I said, acculturation, and I want people to understand that term. They can go look it up and see what it means. But we are becoming more acculturated in the Virgin Islands. We're becoming more like the continental U.S., whether we whether we want to believe it or not. And that is making our risk of diabetes and everything else skyrocket. Now, part of the acculturation process is that we now value convenience. And so what's convenient for us to eat is go to a fast food restaurant and pick up something. Yeah. The more we do that, the more we increase the likelihood that we're going to become insulin resistant. Because not only does weight gain create insulin resistance, but the amount of fat that you consume regularly also can contribute to insulin resistance. Mm. All right?
Yeah.
So acculturation also has influenced the way that we live our lives in a general sense. So like I said before, we no longer... People don't want to have to rake up leaves in the backyard and all that stuff anymore. It's inconvenient. And so we don't put the kind of trees and stuff like were in the backyard when I grew up in town in the 1960s. Everybody had a backyard. We had soursop tree, sugar apple tree, all these sort of things in the backyard. Mm-hmm. The things that helped to sustain us. We didn't know, and the research is slowly showing that these things were protecting us from gaining weight, and they were keeping our blood sugars under control and our blood pressure. Right? I have a YouTube channel where I present all this information on how these natural products that we used to have, and some people still do, protect us. And so when those things disappear, when all we have is some grass in the backyard and a couple of palm trees, we don't have the benefit of those protective factors anymore. So we're at the mercy of the acculturation that's going on, and we eat more fast food, we're being less active, and so on. So that's part of the general trend that has been going on in the Virgin Islands for the last several decades, and that has driven to a large degree the rates of diabetes that we see in the population.
Let me ask this question. The capping of insulin costs. So this thing is really bigger than the average person may know of or aware of?
Yeah, most people don't think in the broader sense. Most people think about what happens to them when they actually have diabetes. So most people are thinking, okay, I have diabetes, I need... here's what I need. The doctor's going to give me some pills, or he's going to tell me to change my diet, or this or that or that. And that's what they think about. They don't think about the general thing. So when people who are come to me and they say, okay, I have diabetes, what can I do? The first thing I always say is, look, let's try to understand why you got diabetes. If you understand why you got diabetes, then you can understand what you need to do to change that around so that you don't... Your blood sugar can now become under control without having to end up having to take insulin or any of these other medications that are out there.
That's good. So so from a visionary standpoint, what should we be looking at in the Virgin Islands? Obviously, more education.
Well, I mean, education helps, but we need to get people more active. We need to get agriculture needs to get people to have more of these health sustaining plants and stuff in their backyards like we did in the old days. For example, I'll give you an example. Mango leaf. Right? There are studies that show that mango leaf contains chemicals that can lower your blood sugar. Mango leaf contains plant chemicals that can keep your weight down. So you drink mango leaf tea, these things happen. Same thing with soursop bush, soursop tea that we used to drink to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now the fact that it helps us to sleep helps to starve off things like dementia and these sort of things, because studies have shown that people sleep less are more prone to developing dementia, right? But also soursop leaves contain chemicals to help burn fat faster, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we were kids, there was hardly any young fat people. right? If there was a fat person, we call them fatty. You know, if you go to school or anything, you call somebody fatty, about 100 people looking at you. Right? So a lot of things have changed, and we are not aware that these changes that have occurred are impacting us individually and as a community, you see? And so understanding these things, and there are things that we can do from a general standpoint as a community to begin to promote. I mean, in promoting these things, that will help us get back to where we need to be, so that the next generation of people, if they're following the traditions of the past, we talk about culture. Culture isn't only about, you know, dressing up, and culture is about how you relate to your environment. And if that relationship changes over time for the negative, then your culture has changed to a large degree for the negative. And so we need to shift back to the way things were in terms of how we relate to our environment and the things that we put in our bodies from the environment that were protecting us from diabetes, hypertension, and all these things that are ravaging the community now. So it's not just about, okay, we need to have more access to the doctors, we need more Medicare, we need more, and that doesn't keep you from getting ill. That helps you once you're ill, but so does the things that you have in your backyard. So, most people, like you said, most people aren't thinking in the broader context. They're thinking only, all right, I got sick, now I need to do this. But if you did these things that helped protect you before, then you will find that you're not as sick as you think, right? If people are trying...
Which means that a little modification here and there could get you back to a better foundation.
Yes, exactly. If you make these changes and you go back to the kind of lifestyle, in terms of the types of things you eat. Now, the old folk ate when the rates were low, you know, get back to activity. Here, there are no things that actually promote activity. I mean, I'll say this, for example, let's say you had to go downtown, you drive downtown, you park inside, you walk a short distance. What if you had to jump on a trolley car and walk here and walk there and walk there? People would get more activity level. So getting people more activity level from a community standpoint would be something important. You could educate people all you want. Education doesn't change behavior. I think this is already clear. As far as health behavior is concerned, you educate people from now to kingdom come. That doesn't change behavior. You have to, when you want to have effective behavior change, you have to create an environment that stimulates the change.
Finally, you getting young people involved in the process, man? Or that's something you're working on in terms of understanding, you know, why data is critical for us to understand where we are and what at a particular point, and how we can make changes to get to a better platform down the road.
Yeah, when the organization was working and was in full force and we had the grants going, I always tried to get sort of programs for young people to get involved. And I've created interventions that involve young people. For example, this is unrelated to diabetes, but you would agree that littering is a problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's been a problem forever. And so I created an intervention that involved young people that could help us get rid of the littering in a year or so. Right? So, yeah, you have to involve young people in the process. And even at the school level, you know, we got to get kids back to understanding the value of the things that we did in terms of what's up and these sort of things, and get them into these sort of things. This is part of Caribbean culture that we've lost, right? And so we have to try to find ways to gain that back, even for the younger generation who's coming up in school and stuff like that. Something like that, programs like that in school, I think would be helpful. And then the kids who are, you know, who are going to be the changers for the next generation, the leaders and the changers, then, yeah, get them involved in things. And I've been trying to do that. But, you know, everything takes money. And one of the things about the difference between being here in the Virgins and being in the United States, if I formed this organization in Pittsburgh, for example, where I spent a lot of my years, then the state would have funds you can apply to. Yeah, the state has nothing. So all the money that comes into the territory comes from the federal government to do public health-related work. Think about that. We don't really have our own public health agenda in the Virgin Islands per se, because it's driven by programs that come from the mainland. So we have mainland-related agenda, not a local agenda. And I don't think, from my days back in health, I can't recall us getting any specific money for public health-related programs except for food safety, right? All the monies came from abroad. So if they come from abroad, they tell you what to do with the money for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if that's another area, like that I said, and that's another area that we have to start to think about in a broader context. How can we put funds, make funds available within the to develop interventions and for people to develop programs to help, you know, get us to where we used to be. And I have to say that way, get us to where we used to be as far as our lifestyles.
Dr. Eugene Teller, I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning. President of the Inter-American Center for Public Health Improvement, Inc. And looking forward to talking with you again down the road.
Appreciate you for having me.
You got it.
Have a great day.
You got it. That's Dr. Eugene Teller talking about how data and the importance of accessing grant financing, grant monies, to conduct these data, know where we at as a people as it relates to our public health. And just in general, though, I think that's why the census is important, you know, because, you know, a correct recording of our population impacts a lot of what is made available to the people of the Virgin Islands and the other insular possessions. You hear me talking about looking out for them as well, right? I have to, because we're on the same boat in that regard. Detached, way smaller than Puerto Rico, don't have the political influence. So the Guams, American Samoa, CNMI, and the Virgin Islands, we need to be of the same mindset and the same tenacity in letting them know that they got to provide for us. We'll take a break, come back, and we'll talk with Omar Ursulek for Flight of Whale in hour number two. We'll be back right after this.
The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect those of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
I'm Aisha Roscoe, host of Weekend Edition Sunday, where we're not just interested in what's going on in the world, but why it's happening and how. Details are important. So are different points of view. We're dedicated to bringing you the stories behind the big events and the small ones, too. Join us every Sunday morning for Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Weekend Edition, Sundays at 9 a.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
Hi, I'm Peter Sagal. You spent the week listening to the news. Don't you think you deserve to show off what you've learned on Wait, We Give You a Chance to Impress Your Friends with your knowledge of international incidents, political gaffes, and the latest advancement in German nudists? You'll be the life of the party or the death. Either way, you'll make an impression and you can thank Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. right here on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.